Thank you, Carla, and thank you everyone for this opportunity to have this dialogue. It's particularly for me a pleasure to be here at the Perimeter Institute. I've been thrilled on spending time yesterday with the future of science. There were, I think, almost 200 young women that joined the event, and it was truly thrilling to see their excitement, their sense of inquiry and exploration. So I want to thank the Perimeter for that opportunity for me to have shared those moments. And today would be just very brief dialogue. I just wanted to share with you, as it has been mentioned by Carla, a little bit what planetary geologists do, because perhaps it's not as well known. It's a fairly new discipline. It really is the partnership between a spacecraft, robotic spacecraft, and humans. And it's a discipline that was started with the exploration space, starting from the first robotic vehicles to the moon. And I will, through the film, the intent is to take you through that sense of exploration and one of the expeditions that led to finding evidence for the discovery of the impact crater that is now known as the Chicxulub impact crater. And then we'll just follow through a Q&A. But I thought that it would be opportune to share some statistics. There was a study that recently NASA did, requested from the Planetary Science Subcommittee, in reference of the status of planetary science, planetary scientists. So this was a survey that it was done. There was a response of, as you can see, 2,623 responded out of the over 4,000 inquiries that were sent out. Of those, 18 PhDs were in planetary science that are currently working in the United States, and 1,200 of those are working full-time on planetary science research. As you can see here, the source of employment is less than half is from university, and NASA employs about 11% full-time, but we do give funding through a peer review research grants of over 50% of the community. And the other 16% are federally funded, 12% from nonprofits, and 9% industry. And the background, as you could see, in education by discipline, you can see that there is a large percentile that comes from the physics background, 21% from geology and geophysics, and less than 10% from chemistry and astronomy and engineering. The demographics, which may be relevant for the topic of today, is there is less than 10% from ethnic minorities, and then one out of four planetary scientists are female. So we still have quite a ways to go there. And there is only 14% of full-time faculty tenure positions are currently held by women. So the workforce production here it shows 48% of the academic departments that include planetary science, approximately 65 of those that award PhDs per year, about 65 per year. And the current hiring rate is about 12 positions per year, or about 18% of the production of PhDs in planetary science are being hired. So it seems like we are in a kind of a steady state. There is the, by the production of the current PhDs that are coming out, that are graduating, and that are being hiring. But the study will probe deeper, and this is, again, it's still in draft form what the numbers that I showed you, and I just wanted to share because of the relevance of today's topic. But the issue on how well the PhD production rate in planetary science matches the demand is something in the non-academic workforce is something is the next phase of the study. Well, and I think with that, then I like to then show you and take you in this exploration adventure that is planetary geology.
Spacecraft, go. Copy that, thank you.
NAP is on internal power, ready for launch.
Copy that, thank you.
Adriana Ocampo is a space explorer. She's not an astronaut. She's a NASA geologist on a quest for space objects on Earth. Not now, but millions of years ago.
I love what I do because it's a dream that we all have to be able to just go and play in the dirt, and I'm able to do it for a living. And in the process, I also learn a lot about science, and that's what keeps it exciting because every moment can be a discovery. Oh my God, guys, we found it! There is enough evidence that has been presented that we can say that there was a big asteroid comet that impacted the Earth and caused a global mass extinction. You really have to be doing the detective work to identify impact craters.
NSC, report spacecraft, go. Spacecraft is go.
10, 9, 8, 7, Dotters arm, green board, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff of the Delta II rocket exploring the past and future of our universe. Vehicle on course.
A planetary geologist has the opportunity of learning more about our planet by studying the planets in our solar system. And it's a relatively young discipline that really got started with the space exploration. We look at images that have been radioed down from the spacecraft that are orbiting Mars, for example, and then we study them in detail and manipulate them with computers and develop different techniques that will allow us to learn from them and then compare it to our own planet, the Earth.
Adriana combs through hundreds of remote sensing photos each year, but one image stands out. It's an ancient impact area in remote South America, and it's become the focus of her field work. Today, she's reviewing the images with geologist Kevin Pope.
Here we have the ground zero then in the Yucatan Peninsula, Chicxulub impact.
We're in the process of planning our expedition to Belize and the Yucatan Peninsula to study the material that created the Chicxulub impact crater 65 million years ago. The Chicxulub story, the study with a Landsat image taken by a spacecraft. There was a very intriguing feature. There was like black dots that were, as you put them together, form a semicircle. These black dots turned out to be pools of water, what they're called sinkholes, or in the Mayan Spanish word would be cenote. And it was very intriguing because this was an enormous feature that you could only see it from a point of view of a spacecraft. It was over 110 kilometers in diameter. It was the surface expression of a buried impact crater.
But to make sure that what they are seeing in the photographs really has occurred in the ancient past, they need to go to the source.
Belize is a wonderful locality. It's very beautiful. There's a lot of lush vegetation and beautiful wildlife.
But it's not your typical place for geologists. Geologists tend to go to deserts, places where you have rocks readily accessible and there is not very much vegetation. This process of finding and searching was quite challenging.
We're in Hummingbird Highway between Belmopan and Armenia.
These localities in Belize are really unique in the world because they are the only ones that show what happens after the first few seconds and minutes and hours after the impact. What we had to do is look for quarries, areas that already man have come and digged up the rock and was quarrying it, in this case, to build the roads in Belize.
Okay, guys, welcome to Albion Quarry. Here we are.
Albion Quarry is enormous. A gaping hole in the ground made from mining boulders to make gravel for roadways. And for all the time that quarry workers have been hard at work making gravel, they've actually created a huge science lab blasted out of the rock. As they make their way to examine the rock layers up close, Adriana's excavators are literally treading on the Chicxulub catastrophe. The ground beneath them is rocks and boulders ejected from the asteroid impact 65 million years ago.
And it's unique in the world because it's the only place where we can come and study the material that was ejected from a large impact event. In the other impact craters around the world that still exist, all this material has been eroded, so we don't have an opportunity to come and study it.
Working in the quarry, Adriana has found a passion for space exploration here on Earth. With each rock sample, she is unearthing clues about heavenly bodies that have impacted our planet in the far, far past.
Since I was a very little girl, I was dreaming about space. It just completely intrigued me. I used to just climb to the roof of my house in Argentina back there and trying to view the stars and wonder what were those sparkle of lights.
Apollo 11, this is Houston. All your systems are looking good going around.
I very much recall very clearly on July 20th, 1969, when I was in Argentina watching through TV the first time a human being stepped its foot in another planet.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
And I realized, gosh, that's fantastic. I couldn't believe we were viewing images from another world. And these incredible soils and rocks, and that completely intrigued me. And I realized I was hooked. And that's how planetary geology came into my life.
Working in the quarry is like stepping back into time.
Let's go back 65 million years ago. There were dinosaurs all over the place. Beautiful lush vegetation, nice coral reefs and leo crabs and fishes all through this area. And then all of the sudden, out of nowhere, a rock came from the sky, probably an asteroid or a comet, impacted on the Yucatan Peninsula. It produced tremendous earthquakes, over 10 in the Richter scale. There was global wildfires that spread to the planet. We had incredible masses of dust and clouds of very poisonous gases that just completely enveloped the whole planet. Our whole atmosphere was completely covered with these very thick clouds of sulfur, of sulfuric acid. So we have sulfuric acid rain, and this effect lasted for about 10 years. That's a long time. It became a very unfriendly place.
So unfriendly that the dinosaurs and many other species died off. A global extinction had taken place.
Yeah, it's
The challenge for Adriana and her team is to find proof that this catastrophe took place here. Today, there is no sign of a crater or the asteroid itself. It's like a crime scene without a body or a weapon. The ground beneath them is not the asteroid, nor is it the crater. It's rocks that were ejected from the ancient impact. The crater is 150 miles away and 1,000 feet below the Earth. But here, all that's left are signs of the tragedy within the rock layers. The most obvious clue is a ribbon of golden sediment that dissects the quarry. It is a dividing line in time, the age of the dinosaurs below and the age of the mammals above. The scientific name for the golden band is the KT boundary. The area below the boundary is a hard rock layer that the miners used to build roads. And hidden within this tough rock is the story of life before the asteroid impact. And inside some rocks are fossils. Not dinosaurs, but small creatures that lived during the time of the dinosaurs.
All of the members of this family have been found in lagoonar environments, very shallow water.
So it's a crab?
It's, it's a crab. Here is the left claw and the right claw in the pincers.
Poor thing was one of the last victims of the impact.
Right,
Really went extinct with the impact.
Right.
So we can really feel now comfortable saying that this is 65 million years that we're working in.
We are very close to the KT.
Okay, so what is the next number?
Throughout the world, the golden band of the KT boundary lines the Earth, but nowhere else on the planet is the layer so deep.
What we're looking here is a beautiful example of the first few seconds after the impact. This is the material that just came at extraordinary velocities and just was deposited here in Belize. In other parts of the world, it's just a few centimeters, and here we have several meters of this material.
Within it, Adriana's researchers are examining special types of rocks, tiny rounded pellets that show evidence of a huge explosion and intense heat. Traveling at lightning speed, the rocks superheated and melted, forming beads of glass. Now, Adriana's researchers are setting up grids to record the measurement of every sizable rock, from pebbles to enormous boulders. The left side of this hill is actually one huge boulder.
It's humongous. It's the size of a house. The amount of energy that it must have imparted is like over 100 million megatons of TNT all going at once. You know, to have been able to move such tremendous masses over 230 kilometers away. So this boulder is composed of the same rock as the asteroid comet impacted, so it's part of the target rock.
Adriana needs more than one source of evidence to prove her theory that the Chicxulub impact took place. She wants to know how widespread the devastation was. To do that, she needs to prove the evidence at Albion Quarry isn't a fluke, a chance happening.
We cannot just find one single locality. It's very rare that would provide us with all the answers. We needed to find how extensive this was. Can we see those same rocks someplace else?
And for that, Adriana needs plenty of help.
Having the volunteers from the Planetary Society has been an incredible help.
I was a police detective for 27 years, and I retired last year. And I promised myself once I retired, I'd go on an expedition, because I'm really interested in geology.
I'm a truck driver. I'm on a trucking business. And I've always had an interest in science.
Scientist really is a good observer. And I think we are all scientists in all different ways. Being a keen observer, being able to note maybe subtle differences, and that's what all of these people share. They really are very good observers, and the volunteers have been tremendous in that way.
And I'm really, really loving this. It's as fun as any major undercover work I did in police work. It's putting all the clues together, gathering evidence carefully, taking notes, and then making a decision on what happened. Only in this case, nobody goes to jail.
New clues are emerging from a newly discovered rock sample called Pook's Pebbles.
So these limestones were traveling, re-entering, heating up. These very unique textures and features, like the shine in the rock, like indentations, they got plasticized and they got basically imprinted for posterities, for future geologists to find.
Adriana has been trying to pinpoint how close she can find evidence to the original source of the impact. So the team heads to the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. Here, the group is searching the area closest to ground zero.
In Mexico, we have these pieces, these type of rocks, but spread all in different areas. So the challenge is locating them and then putting them together. And so here, right here, this surface represents that period of time. So we are pre-impact, post-impact. This little line here is that contact point. Actually, this locality that we just discovered now has become the closest locality to the impact in the world.
But just collecting samples of rocks in the field won't tell the whole story.
It's indicative of a rock that has been exposed to very high temperatures. And we believe that they were thrown from the Chicxulub impact crater all the way from the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico to Belize, over 500, 600 kilometers away.
Scientific investigations require looking within the rocks for more specific clues, clues that can't be seen with the naked eye. One piece of evidence is called shocked quartz, the size of a grain of sand. The tiny streaks running through this grain show the pressure of the impact that literally shocked the quartz.
There is enough evidence on the table that has been presented that we can say that indeed the extinction of the dinosaurs was caused by a massive impact in our planet and bringing about global destruction.
NASA and the MAPS spacecraft are ready for launch.
Why do we explore? The reasons that people climb mountains, the reason that people explore the oceans, the reasons that we send spacecraft to the farthest reaches of our universe is to enhance an understanding. Planetary geologists have a tremendous challenge, because we cannot go to Mars or we cannot go to the moon very easily. So we have to make comparisons. Where can we go to the Earth to try to study those similar processes? As planetary geologists, we always have to, in a sense, be thinking about the stars or keeping our feet on the ground.
Those last few relaxing notes can start off our conversation. One of the things, Adriana, first of all, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, and it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me about this story was the story that you just told, is that planetary geology is a new field, and then another piece of the picture was when you were describing as a girl looking up at the stars and wondering what those points of light were and being awestruck by watching people walk on the moon. And then now, one of the most important women in science. And so what I'm curious is how you managed to go from that girl being just awestruck by this and fascinated by this field into a new field of science. And finally, like, how did you make that career happen? What are some influences or stories that went along the way?
Well,
I think my first inspiration were my parents. I was very fortunate to have extraordinary parents that they told us, you know, you study hard, you have a dream, you study hard and it can become true, and you have to be persistent at it even through events of difficulties that will happen. So that was my path. And even though I grew up in a developing country where space was really not part of the lexicon then, and when that opportunity opened up with my parents decided to emigrate to the United States, the first thing I wanted to find out is where is NASA, and that had become my dream, to work and be part of that world of space exploration. And throughout all that, I think persistence played a key role on it. And that sense of awe and inquiring and wanting to know more, and never being afraid of asking probably too many questions. And even if I found, a barrier, to me, it truly wasn't a barrier. It was a way to maybe find a different way to approach a problem or a career path. And I started volunteering. As soon when we immigrated to the United States, I volunteered to work at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is the center of excellence that NASA has for solar system exploration. So for me, it's like I had arrived to Disneyland. That was an incredible playground. And to this day, they have a program in which they encourage students from high school to come and hear lecture, and they are mentored in different areas of science and technology. So I was fortunate to be part of that program, and then started as a technical aide as the lowest of the lowest level of job in the NASA scheme. And then they just couldn't get rid of me. I just continued working as I was going to university.
Well, thank you. When I look at your story, one of our reasons for being here today is to try to make the path for women and members of underrepresented groups easier as they go into science and technology careers. And so if you look back at your story, and if you had a magic wand, are there any things that you would change that you think would make that path that you took one that required less persistence?
Well, I think I probably should have gotten my PhD earlier. That was one of the things that has been a challenge. So I had long gaps between my bachelor and then my master's and then the PhD. And it was partly because I had to work as I was going through school, and that took a long time. And then I got very involved in the works that I was doing in the flight programs. I gave it my all, and that was very enticing. So maybe that I should have made those gaps shorter than what I did.
So that's something that you could have done. What if you had some control over the world around you, or more control over the world around you, to go and say, I'll change this and I'll change this?
Well, indeed, when I started in this area, I started as an aerospace engineer, actually, and then changed paths to planetary geology when that started as a discipline. But there weren't that many women, so there was not a reflection of myself that I could see. And certainly having more diversity would have been a tremendous asset. That's an area that it has gotten better. There is a lot more diversity in the field, but certainly we can use a lot more. So those opportunities is a wonderful thing that I think I would love to, and I'll try to continue help to make that happen.
Thank you. One of the things that I've seen is that you've done really a lot of mentoring work, and your eyes sort of light up when you talk about that. And there's a group, Latina Women of NASA. Could you tell us a little bit about what that group is and what it does?
Well, what we try to do is really network and help the next generation of researchers, engineers, and technologies come to play. So I think it's an effort to bring that about. And so through Latinas at NASA, and we have developed programs. We do mentoring activities. And through the webpage, try to outreach. So it's a network that NASA has different 13 centers throughout the United States, and we are all linked through that website, and continue doing those type of efforts of mentorings to bring the next generation of scientists and engineers and technologists.
And so, if the rest of us were to follow in your footsteps, so you've done a lot of great work mentoring and helping other women step forward. If you were to offer us help so that we could do some of that work for you, or offer us advice, what might you tell us to do?
Well, currently I'm involved in, I think, in a very exciting project. This was actually started by Dr. Sumatra Mitra from India. Mm-hmm. It's called Hole in the Wall. And I don't know how many of anybody in the audience has heard of that, Hole in the Wall. No, it's a way to use technology to reach the poorest levels of society. How to reach children that perhaps do not have access to education. So what Dr. Mitra did is he is from India, and he took a wall, he made a hole, and he put a computer. Mm-hmm. And in that, in a very, very poor area of India, and then he put a little camera and observed what happened. He left it there for about 3 months. He was astonished to find out when he came back, these children who were children of the street, they had taught themselves how to use the computer, and because they wanted to learn how to play games. They actually had learned a little bit of English. They had, they were teaching other children. And he realized the potential of how a child can learn by themselves to a certain degree, and how that could help society reach, you know, and educate. So a different mode of education. So. When I heard of this, I wrote to Dr. Mitra, and I said that I love that example and what he was doing, and I would like to try to do it in South America. So now we have started a hole in the wall in uh-huh. Colombia, and we are doing that as an experiment and see how it's working out. So it's a way to use technology to help society.
Well, thank
through
you.
Education.
So what I'd like to do right now is be less bossy and invite other people. If you have questions for Adriana, what I'll do is I'll keep a list, and we have time to continue our conversation a little bit more, including more people. So imagine the soft tones of the music while you think about what you might want to ask. Yes?
Well, I think is the role, I think, of public education is key, because that's where the young minds are exposed to, you know, on the first stages. So the thing to bring it as provide as many options as possible to expose children to different topics. At the earliest age possible, I think a child today could understand quantum physics if they are taught. So it's a matter of starting to bring that knowledge, something that we're not exposed to, and we have to make education evolve faster and use new techniques, new approaches. So, I think it's a great opportunity for public education to produce new ways of thinking, and maybe we're not being as proactive in those areas as we need to be. So, but I certainly, the role of public education is key.
The woman in the white sweater?
Yeah, you mentioned the fact that radiologists and
Planetary science evolved through robotic exploration, and it was started in California, actually. I think we're one of the first universities that started it, and it has spread now, you know, but I think in the US we're one of the first universities where you could get a bachelor's degree and eventually a master's and a PhD. So there's now several universities throughout the world that have it, but not that many. I think the community of planetary scientists worldwide is probably no more than 5,000, or depending, you know, how you define it, but it still is a small community. It was in the 60s. Yes, it was in the 60s, yeah, with the first. So, and I think, you know, planetary, it is a growing discipline. There's hopefully we as a planet will continue sending robotic probes with potential human exploration. So if we need to have a community that understands that path of exploration, that information, that new techniques, and develop new ways of doing that exploration, so it's a discipline that I believe has a tremendous growth potential. I'm trying to work with Latin American universities to start programs in planetary science. Yes, definitely, it's one of the also another pet project that I have, and there are several we have had. With the help of also the United Nations Office of Aerospace Affairs, develop a series of workshops for developing countries, not only in Latin America, although we have had several workshops there in basic space science, as they call it, but includes also planetary science, and will continue. We had educational events also to the high school level, in which we outreach 24,000 students at the different ages, in from elementary to secondary school in Latin America, and we'll continue to do those type of events. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your question.
Mark?
Is it on? Mm-hmm. Is it going? Okay. Hi. I am a professor who comes from the arts and humanities. And something interesting there when we're looking at stats in terms of over 50% of our undergraduates are women, both at the undergraduate and now at the MA level. A number of us, in terms of hiring, they're increasingly, the numbers are much better at the faculty level, lower as you get up. But one thing, even with the large numbers of women in arts and humanities, we still continue to talk about something called a climate or an atmosphere, so that even in terms of numbers, they're there, but there's still an issue of what's the climate like, what's the atmosphere for women to work. I'm just wondering, in terms of, I know it might be a difficult issue in terms of airing dirty laundry in public or politics of it, but would you be able to talk to what's the climate or the atmosphere like at NASA for women working?
Yes, thank you. It's indeed a very good question, a very good area. I have been in the field now long enough that I've seen the evolution. Early on, as I mentioned, there were a lot less women in the field, and it's been very satisfying to see that diversity grow. In NASA, for example, we have the great fortune that it truly is a talent-oriented environment, and your capabilities really develop the path, and the opportunities are there. I haven't felt that gender has been a hindrance for growth. We have our deputy administrator in the agency, who is a woman, and we have several positions of directors and that are held by women, and as well, even within our planetary science directorate. So we have center directors For example, Johnson Space Center, the director is a woman. So we have a lot of key positions. Not to say that we still need more growth, mm-hmm. We still need more diversity. But overall, I have felt that if you bring a new and a good idea to the table, it will be listened to no matter what your gender is. That's the environment that NASA has. And one key aspect too is that there is an environment in which we deal with very high risk activities overall. So the potential of failure is there all the time. And what we do day to day is how to manage risk, to mitigate that failure. And one of the things that I have admired most is really being part of and learning that process in which we pause and think, pause and share, and lessons learned. And it's not in an environment of fine or fault, but an environment of how we can do it better. And I think that has proved to be extraordinarily beneficial to provide an environment of innovation and growth for the employees and the people and the family of NASA. And I refer to it as family because it's really broader than just the 13 center that the agency has. We consider the academia, as it was mentioned before, I mentioned almost over 50% of academia, they are part of the investigative force. So that's part of the family of NASA. So it's not only the agency, but we work intimately. And all the new ideas and concepts really come from the science community at large. And that science community include our international partners, which are key to also the developing of all these new ideas. So I don't know if I answered your question, if I went a little bit broader than you were expecting, but thank you for the question.
So we have time for one more question. If someone, I have to do my looking into the light things. Yes.
Hi.
Oh, 1 second, please.
And
thank you.
Hi. And it's very, very fascinating. So my question is, what are some future prospects of the field that you're currently right now, and what are some challenges for women and for just people in general in this field? And if you care to share some insights and information on the future projects you're planning to work on and be involved with.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your question and your comment. I truly appreciate it. I think it's extraordinary. I'm a complete fan of space exploration. I'm, of course, a bias, but the key questions that we as humans have been trying to address, where we came from, is there life somewhere else in the universe? Those are all questions that through space exploration we will be able to answer. I truly believe that. And the fact that right now we have rovers on other surfaces like Mars, and the Curiosity spacecraft, I think the Curiosity rover that is there is the most ambitious rover that has been developed by humans. It has the capability of truly being able to address that key question: was there ever life on Mars in a past or present? And there's a press conference, I think, coming up. I don't know if it is actually happening this afternoon on the latest results of the drilling. The Curiosity rover will be providing some true insights on potential niches of trying to understand origin of life. So, and we have other incredible key areas even within our solar system. When we started space exploration, we thought potentially life was only on Earth. That's the only example we know for sure. But now we have, since the thinking has evolved through the information provided by this robotic spacecraft, that there are other places like Enceladus, Europa. Europa is one of the moons of Jupiter, which contains the three key ingredients of potential life as we know it: liquid water, organic material, and a source of energy. Jupiter is really like a protostar, you may say it. If it had become more massive, it would have emitted, it still emits more energy than it receives. So it's, the Jupiter system is like a mini solar system within our solar system, and Europa could be a niche for life again as we know it, and a mission to explore that through joint international collaboration is in the future as well. So it, and so all this wide breadth of areas of exploration, I think, are very, very exciting for humanity. And in the future, this type of exploration will be viable through international collaboration. Another personal dream that I have is to really eventually see our continents, South America, Central America, and North America, jointly work together to have maybe a joint co-op in space and bring about more accessibility to all the countries of at least for exploration. I think jointly we can do a lot more than what we can do as a country, separate countries. So, and that's a model that I know eventually in a future ahead it will happen for our planet as we move forward. We know that our sun has a limited lifetime. So as it's been said so many times, you know, the Earth is our cradle, but we need to move forward and go explore the stars, and that's really path of our future as a civilization. So hopefully that we will be done as a planet in the future. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ocampo. What you've brought to us today is your example and a role model as someone who does fascinating science, but also someone who has put so much effort into effectively helping other people do excellent science. And so thank you so much for sharing your ideas and your career with us.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. Appreciate it.